gotcha. Right.
Boom. We're recording then.
Cool. That's what I like to hear. I basically had mind just talking to you a bit about your comedy past and present, maybe even future, you know?
I don't know how much of a comedy past I have. I've only been doing it for a handful of years, so.
Yeah. Well, when I started, doing open mics, you were one of the guys that just, you were like crushing at mics.
Those were the glory days, right? Yeah. Now it's over. I peaked. It's true. I peaked in 2010. Let's admit it. Now it's all downhill.
Well, I want to know what happened. I saw you, last time I saw you, you brought your mom to the parlor open mic. she loved it. She was all over it.
She had a blast, which is really kind of weird because, and maybe you've had this experience too, typically comics, when they start out and they go to open mics, you know, there's a little bit of favoritism played toward you by the club. A lot of clubs, if you bring a guest or whatever, so you'll bring a friend or you'll bring your girlfriend or whatever. But after like the fourth or fifth time of like, hey, come down to this crappy open mic and sit in the heat for 3 hours and watch it, nobody wants to come with you anymore. Yeah. They get burned out on it. And then the irony is my mom lives in Indiana. So she was just up here to visit me for a couple weeks, and she was, oh, I got to see you do your comedies and blah, blah. And I thought, yeah. Oh, my God, this is going to be the worst thing. Because she's, like, in her 60s and whatever.
Right.
But she's still, you know, fairly open-minded. And she loved it, man. She loved every sec, even, like, the moments where everybody cringes. She just grinned.
Oh,
maybe, you know, she
awesome.
Doesn't get out much, I guess.
Yeah, but she also has the entire context of you as a person.
That's true. That's true.
A lot more than the audience, anyway.
And I'd at least been doing it long enough at that point that I wasn't so self-conscious that I would censor myself just because my mom was there, you know? And,
yeah.
So I did, like, all the jokes that I was doing at the time, which may or may not have been mom-friendly. But, you know, she laughed. She had a good time. And she loved meeting all the other comics. And I guess maybe that's where I get it from, you know, because she said if she were younger, she would be doing stand-up today, too, which would be very bizarre. Just to think of my mom up there on stage, that's a whole different
thing. Well, there's like a lot of parents that who are at least mildly supportive of their kids doing comedy now. They all seem like people like that who either tried and then like life got in the way, or they just never got around to starting but have always been a fan. So they're like, yeah, I would have done it if it wasn't for you, so now I can live vicariously through you.
Yeah, that's true. I definitely ruined my mom's life in many ways and prevented her from living out many dreams, and perhaps comedy was one of those. But she loves it. Even, you know, I used to videotape all my performances and watch them back. I don't really do that as much anymore. And she would, like, always beg me to, like, YouTube it and send it to her, even though it's, like, 3 minutes me at my worst, like, going up last. And I got to see it. I got to have it. So, I don't know. I guess it's cool that she's supportive like that. I've talked to some people whose parents aren't as supportive. But then again, she lives 3,000 miles away. So, you know, if I killed cats for a living, she'd probably still want video, too. So, what do you do?
It's just our way of seeing you. Now, what happened? I guess did you take a break after that?
Yeah, I took a little time off. Things got weird at the job I had. And I had to look for a new job and simultaneously move out of the place that I was living in. And I was running low on funds. And one of the things that maybe not a lot of people realize who aren't doing comedy, it costs money to, like, go to open mics on a regular basis, you know?
Yeah.
And in gas and iced teas and everything else that I indulge in at open mics, you know, you could spend $40 in one night easily. And then another thing that happens quite frequently is I get a parking ticket. So then my open night, you know, open mic experience balloons up to like $70 or $80.
Jeez, yeah.
So I just kind of, you know, and plus comedy's a weird thing. Like, for me, I had to go through a phase of trying to figure out how to handle it emotionally, if that makes sense, without sounding too emo.
What do you mean, when you were going, when you were, like, during that break, you were figuring out how to do comedy and handle it emotionally, or just...
Comedy's a weird thing, and it's such a roller coaster, and there's so many moments where you have the best time of your life, and it's amazing, and you have... so many moments that are the equally proportionate opposite of those experiences where you just have the worst time of your life.
Very extreme ups and downs.
Yeah, and it's difficult to adjust to that, especially when it's, for a lot of people who are just starting out, it's not the primary focus of your life. Like, you got a day job that you got to deal with, and you got all these people during the day that you got to deal with, and then at night you go and you do these things, and it's such a crazy emotional roller coaster. And then there's, you know, there can be drama and cliques and little weird high school-y type things that start happening while you're going on these ups and downs. And so, you know, all of those factors combined, I felt like maybe I just needed to take a moment to, like, kind of sit down and figure out what comedy was to me and why I was doing it and what I wanted to get out of it and if I could even afford to do it and not get paid to do it, because, you know.
That is an incredible financial drain.
I think, you know, and maybe this speaks more to my lack of talent, but I've been paid like I've made a few hundred dollars, probably. And that's not like, that's like over like the course of the, you know, and that's the other terrible thing is like a lot of places will want to pay you, like, here's a beer. We'll give you a beer to perform. You know, I
can't. That's your first show pay.
Yeah, I can't pour this in my truck and drive home, you know, so.
And what's worse, though, if you do drink, that just starts you drinking more. You're like, oh, well, you gave me my first two drinks. I'm going to buy a third or fourth.
Yeah, comedians are full. The comedy community is full of either alcoholics or recovering alcoholics. There's nobody who's like, there's no social drinkers in comedy circles. Let me just put it that way.
Oh, my God. Okay, so we were talking about the ups and downs, and one of the things that's been pumped into my head a lot as something to try and think about is take away like the emotional gain from a great set, so you can take away the emotional gain or like, you know, detriment from a bad set. So like if the results aren't exactly like what your entire stake as a being is being put into, then it won't be as painful, and you could just look at it like objectively.
Yeah. It's funny. And this comes up a lot in a lot of the comedy podcasts that I've been in is you have to find this weird fine line between caring and not caring. Like, obviously you care about it. You do it because, you know, somewhere you want to get that laugh. But I think eventually, and again, I haven't been doing it that long, so my opinion is really just my opinion, but I think eventually some people like myself have to find a mindset where your enjoyment on stage isn't dependent on that laugh, you know, because you have to have a good time on stage, and if you're not having a good time on stage, two things. One, whoever's watching you is not going to have a good time, and two, there's so many other things you could be doing. Why are you wasting your time when everybody else is up on stage if you're not enjoying? And you see it all the time, especially at open mics. People who get up on stage and then they're just miserable. And you don't understand that it happens over and over and over again. So, but I think it's easy to get in this mindset where when people laugh, it feels good. It's validation and it's great. And so it's easy for people to get in this mindset where they feel like if no one's laughing, they're not enjoying it. They're dependent. The comedian's not enjoying it. You know, their enjoyment is dependent on the audience's laughter. And if it's not there, then suddenly they think, oh, this is terrible. I'm having a bad time. And, you know, that can start a real downward spiral, you know.
Well, I think you nailed it earlier is when they're listening. That silence isn't bad, but that listening, if you can understand that that's just as good as laughing sometimes, you can take a bit of that edge off.
Yeah, and every comic I've ever seen that looked like they were having a good time on stage has always done well. And people just like to see, because that's why they're there. The audience is there because they want to have a good time. And if they see somebody on stage having a good time, they're like, I like this guy. He's fun. He's having a good time. They don't have to be laughing hysterically. They just have to be enjoying themselves. And I guess that's what I try to do now is just do it to enjoy it and not really have any other ulterior motive. Not like, oh, I'm going to make everybody laugh their asses off, or someday I'm going to be a big star, or I'm going to hustle and run around and try to make all this stuff happen and start these little cliques and groups and whatever. You know, I just, you know, I'm going to go tell jokes, right? So, I don't know.
Yeah.
It sounds strange, but for me, it was hard to get to that place. It was hard to get to a place where I took it seriously enough to dedicate the time and effort and energy to do it, but not so serious that all these things depended on me like doing it successfully, you know?
Right.
So
now, I mean, that almost seems to have like a hint of Buddhism or like Zen to it. And why I bring that up is I heard a rumor that you're at least somewhat knowledgeable and that you're really excited about these paintings behind us. and that's what I wanted to know about. Tell me more about these paintings.
Well, first of all,
they're not there anymore.
They've been moved. I know what paintings you're talking about because they're mine. We moved them because some people who were in here had this crazy theory that putting foam padding on the wall would fix whatever perceived sound issues may or may not exist in here. But
I think it would take a little more than that.
Yeah. Instead, now we have this strange art installation replacing the prior art installation, which were Tibetan Buddhist paintings. I don't know if it's just my life. I'm assuming it's everybody's life, but it seems like the strangest, most random, unforeseen coincidences turn out to be the biggest influences in a person's life.
Yeah,
you know?
Definitely.
And that kind of is how Buddhism came into my life. Like, I don't even know where to begin because it kind of goes deep now that I think about it.
Well, can I start you off by throwing out a little, it's almost like a theory.
Theory.
Because I've seen Buddhism seems to speak to me more than a lot of Western philosophical structures. And I think a big part of that is I didn't grow up around it. So it's kind of, I access it at my own speed almost rather than having it thrown in my face constantly.
Yeah,
so it's not that it may be inherently better or worse. It's just that if you can access it on your terms, it's a lot more fun to start actually exploring it. I don't know.
Yeah, I stumbled into it. I had a very bizarre experience. I grew up in Indiana, and when I was in my late teens, I moved to Bloomington, Indiana, which is where Indiana University is.
My brother went there, actually.
Yeah, I didn't go because I was a loser, drunkard, stoner. So I just kind of like wandered around the streets, like literally. I was young, too. I was like 18, maybe. I was like 17 or 18 when I left home. And so, you know, I just took odd jobs here and there, you know, deliver pizzas, wash dishes, whatever. And one day I stumbled into this cafe on 4th Street. And asked for a job washing dishes, and it was called the Norbu Cafe. It was this Asian cafe. That's all I knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
And long story short, I don't really know the best way to describe this. There was this old guy that came in all the time, and the place was owned by this lady named Konya Norbu. And I always just called her Mrs. Norbu, and I just knew her as like this old Asian lady that owned the place and was always there. She was like my boss.
Yeah.
And we were like pretty much, it was a small cafe, so we were pretty much the entire kitchen staff. It was just her and me in this little kitchen smaller than the studio, just chopping vegetables and like hanging out all day. And her husband would come in from time to time all the time, really old guy. And she would always call him Rinpoche. And their kids owned a restaurant called the Snow Lion next door. And sometimes they would come in there. Jigme, their son, he would come in there, and he would also call this guy Rinpoche. And so I'm thinking, well, how come there's no dad? How come there's no husband? How come there's no love talk? How come, like, I thought Rinpoche was the guy's name.
Yeah.
So it turns out Rinpoche is actually a title. And it's a title that's reserved for a certain class of Tibetan Buddhist monk from like the old school, like from Tibet proper before the Chinese occupation. And Rinpoche is like the school of monks who take what's called the Bodhisattva vow, where they vow to reincarnate until all sentient beings achieve enlightenment. And so that's why they get this special title, you know, yeah. Rinpoche. And so it turns out, and I had no idea, like I just stumbled in there because I wanted to wash some dishes because I was pretty much just living on the streets. And it turns out Rinpoche was the Dalai Lama's eldest brother.
Holy
and
crap.
I didn't know this at all until, like, it was so funny. One day I walked in there and I asked Rinpoche, I was like, so is Rinpoche like a common Tibetan name? Because I thought it was a name and not a title. And he laughed and laughed and he was very humble about it. And he's like, oh, it's more like a title, like doctor, you know, or whatever. And so I went home and did the research. And that's when I was like, really? Is this who I think this is? And it turns out, I'm not really 100% sure how it happened, but after he immigrated to the United States, Indiana University offered him a job teaching Tibetan and Asian culture studies. And so he taught a course at the university there for a few years, and they purchased a tract of land out on the outskirts of Bloomington. It's still there. It's called the Tibetan Cultural Center. And they lived out there, and presumably they had a sizable amount of funds, whether it be from his pension at the university or whatever they managed to take with them from Tibet.
Yeah.
Because they were royalty in Tibet, basically. And they opened up first, their son, Jigme Norbu, opened up the Snow Lion. And then like a block down, they opened up the Norbu Cafe, which was Jigme's mom's gig. And so for a good few years, I hung out all day long with the Dalai Lama's sister-in-law and brother. And we'd make momos and like whatever in the kitchen, and just like I'd work these, because we were the only kitchen staff, so I'd work like these 10, 12 hour shifts.
Yeah.
And that was my day, like every day for weeks, just hanging out with these people. And they weren't like, they didn't like preach. They weren't evangelical.
Right.
You know, in fact, we very rarely like talked about Buddhism, but we didn't really necessarily need to, just because of the stories and the things that we did talk about and the points of view and perspectives
right.
that they did have. And
you think it was more of like a they would show you rather than tell you?
Well, again, I don't think it was their intention.
I mean, not even on purpose, but just like if they're living it, then you can see it.
There was just a very clear and distinct cultural divide between myself and Rinpoche and Mrs. Norbu, because they lived in Tibet proper for, you know, all the way up until the early 50s, which is when the occupation happened. And so they had this incredible journey from being exiled from their own home country to coming to the United States. And there was a distinct cultural gap, you know. I mean, the Tibetan society and culture was pretty far behind American, you know, society and culture in terms of technological achievements and just the way people live their day-to-day lives when they came over here. So they had quite the hill to climb and the learning curve. And they had all, like, they actually were kind of hesitant, I guess, to talk about Buddhism to people, because if you're going to live in Indiana, Bloomington is the town to do it in.
Right.
All other towns in Indiana are the worst.
Why is that?
They're the redneckiest of the redneck. Like, everybody drives a pickup truck and listens to John Cougar Mellencamp. I've been told I even have a little bit of, like, a hick accent or whatever, which is probably true. So, like, Bloomington is the best place to live because it's a university town, so you're going to get, like, younger people and a mix of whatever. So it's
just learning stuff.
yeah, right, you know, people from all over who haven't, like, lived in Indiana their whole lives. And I don't know if you've seen, like, well, you've seen those paintings over there. You know, that's an example of Tibetan, like, religious art, you know. The Tibetan Buddhism is rich with all sorts of paintings and art and things like that. And so it's also really common for people who practice certain schools of Tibetan Buddhism to have, like, a little altar space in their house or whatever, and they'll put some of these paintings up and whatnot, and they represent different deities, and they pray and whatever. So Mrs. Norbu had, like, a little space in the cafe, like, in the back room. She had, like, it was really just the size of a broom closet, and she had, like, a picture of the Dalai Lama on the wall, and she had, they're called tankas, which are paintings usually on cloth that they would hang from the walls, and they're paintings of, like, the Buddha, like, various different Buddhas, like the Compassionate Buddha or whatever, different deities throughout the pantheon. And you've seen those. I think some people who may be a little shallow-minded might take a look at those paintings and start to think, you know, demonic thoughts, like, because they're strange, they're weird. Because some of these deities, their purpose is to scare off, you know, negative influences. So they have these garish appearances, you know. And so when they moved to Indiana and lived next to this pig farm out there in Bloomington, for a while the neighbors were convinced that they were all devil worshippers or Satanists or whatever. And so they kind of felt like they had to hide, like, some of this aspect of their life. Because, and I'd worked there for like a year and got to know her very well by spending, like, you know, 8 to 12 hours a day, 5 days a week with her, before she even, like, took me back there and, like, showed me, like, her little, like, special place, because she'd be worried that most people would see the stuff on the wall and think she was back there, like, sacrificing babies or whatever. But it was crazy times hanging out with those people. Every once in a while, because these people were still considered royalty in Tibetan circles, especially the religious circles, so every once in a while, some of these really high-up monks would come down, and I'd be cooking dinner for, like, this table of, like, legit, like, robe-wearing, shaved-head, like, only speak Tibetan monks. And I don't know if you ever saw 7 Years in Tibet. There's a guy named Heinrich Harrer who wrote a book called 7 Years in Tibet. He's an Austrian mountain climber, and he got trapped in the mountains when there was a conflict between India and I forget the other country that was involved a long time ago. And he ended up stuck in Tibet. Like, he hiked his way into Tibet. And at the time, Westerners weren't allowed in Tibet. He was one of the first Westerners in Tibet, him and his friend Peter Alschneider, I think was his name. And they lived there for 7 years. They actually got to know the Dalai Lama and his family, and Norbu Rinpoche, who was the guy that I knew. And he wrote a book about it called 7 Years in Tibet. Amazing book. And they made a movie starring Brad Pitt, of all people, called 7 Years in Tibet many years ago. Heinrich Harrer stopped in and, like, hung out. And, and he spoke Tibetan fluently, so he hung out and talked to Rinpoche all night. That's a very strange coincidence.
Yeah,
I just went in there to wash dishes in Bloomington, Indiana, of all places. And those were the people
that I bumped into.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, Rinpoche was a great guy. He spent a lot of time out there at the cultural center with his dogs and his garden. He loved his dogs and his garden. And he was hilarious. He was a really good guy. He died a few years ago. And unfortunately, Jigme did too. They do these peace walks because Tibet, I don't know if you're aware of the political situation in Tibet. I hate to turn your fucking podcast
into
you know, Tibetan rights and all that, but they do these walks because Tibet is occupied by China right now. So Tibet is considered Chinese territory.
Right.
And it's kind of a sticking point because if you read about and talk to people who lived through it, like Rinpoche and his friends, the way China invaded Tibet is just absurd. Because it was a country that was ruled by religion, and the religion was a peaceful one. It wasn't a fanatical one at all. Like, they didn't even have an army. And what happened was the CIA came over and actually gave them weapons and guns to fight off China for a while. And nobody knew about that for a long time. They actually flew a lot of these Tibetans over to the United States and trained them in paramilitary training, and then flew them back into the Tibetan mountains to fight these people. And when it became obvious that it was a losing battle, the CIA just kind of washed their hands of the whole deal and said, we don't know what's going on.
Sure.
And so to this day, there's lots of issues because China consistently gets most favored nation trade status, and they get very favorable trade terms and financial support and so forth from the United States, even though now they practically own us because of that status. But a lot of human rights people say, how can you do this when they've committed these human rights atrocities to Tibetans? You know, they murdered nuns and abbots and monks and raised the monasteries, you know. I mean, when you typically are in a war with another country, you're going after military installations. But again, this was a country that was ruled by religion, so they were going after, like, monasteries, right? They're bombing monasteries full of nuns and monks and whatnot.
Attacking the power structure.
Yeah.
That's the one that was
there. But it's so absurd when you think about it, because their power structure are like old celibate men who, like, meditate all day hoping that all sentient beings can achieve peace and happiness, you know? And then the Chinese, well, these are the guys we got to kill. And, you know, people, friends of Rinpoche's would come into the cafe all the time, and they, a few of them wrote books and had pictures and were able to smuggle some of the implements of torture out that they would torture these guys with, because some of the monks, the abbots, they realized, well, these are important people, so we don't want to just off them. We'll take them and we'll, like, you know, we'll use them as leverage for bargaining if we ever need any sort of political leverage. So, you know, 70-year-old men that now have, like, scars all over their bodies and their hands and their feet from being tortured for years in these, like, Chinese prisons. And it's a real hot spot. Like, the weird thing is, too, like, these dudes, should have got me started, man. These Chinese dudes would come into the cafe like probably like 2 or 3 times a month, and they were students at the university, but they'd all show up and they'd all have suits and glasses on and notebooks, and they would come in there and they would like want a glass of water or whatever. They'd sit down and they'd look around and they would literally like be writing stuff. And at first I didn't even like think anything about it or whatever. I mean, they seemed awkward or whatever, but Miss Norba would always kick them out. And I thought she was being paranoid, but it turns out later I found out pretty definitively that these guys, that was their job, was to spy on the Norbu family and see what they were doing and report back to China, because these people were still considered political dissidents, you know.
That's
and
wild.
So long story short, that's how Jigme died, but it was accidental. He, like I think maybe 3 years ago or so, he was doing what they call a peace march, where they would walk, you know, across the country or whatever to raise awareness for human rights in Tibet. And he was hit by a car in Florida, I think.
Jeez.
And so, yeah, Rinpoche died of natural causes maybe 6 years ago or so. But Jigme got hit by a car about 3 or 4 years ago. So now it's just Miss Norbu out there. And she has help, too, of course.
Yeah. That's wild, though. I'm so glad I asked you about those posters. Holy crap.
Oh, yeah. Well, so when I moved to Seattle, Tibetan antiquities are kind of rare because when the Chinese came into Tibet, they destroyed most of them. They burned down the monasteries and all this stuff. And also one of the themes central to Buddhism is the non-permanence, the impermanence of everything.
Right.
So
that's a big thing that got me at least looking in that direction.
Yeah, and so one of the consequences of this idea of impermanence is whenever they would create these really elaborate paintings or structures or altars or whatever, they didn't care if they just were exposed to the elements and, you know, faded away, because that was all kind of in tune with this whole idea of impermanence. So Tibetan antiquities are kind of hard to find unless you live in a major city like Seattle. And when I moved out here, it's actually just down the street. I forget what it's called, Distant Lands or something like that.
Okay.
They have a lot of Tibetan antiquities and artifacts. And after hanging out with, there's a lot of fakes out there too, but after hanging out with Mrs. Norbu and Norbu Rinpoche, I kind of got a feel for like what was authentic and what's not. Because out there at the Tibetan Cultural Center, they have all kinds of stuff. And anybody's welcome to go there. If you live in Bloomington, at least back in the day, I don't know if it's still this way, but you could just show up and knock on the door and they would like walk you around and show you what's going on. So, you know, there was a time period when I had a little bit of money to spend. And so I bought a few Tibetan artifacts because it's just fascinating. As far as I'm concerned, I could stare at those paintings for hours.
Well, you
could
buy, you know, you could buy like $200 sunglasses, or you could buy something that has some meaning to you.
That's true. Yeah, I don't.
I bring that up just because I live in a world now where people are just throwing away $200 sunglasses every day, and it's wild to me.
Well, and playing like Xbox and PS3, and like I don't have any of that stuff. Like I don't play any video games or anything like that. What I spent my money on was those paintings. And
yeah.
And I guess I'm crazy in my own way, because like somebody could sit down and play Call of Duty for 4 hours or whatever. I could probably stare at those paintings for 4 hours and get like more out of the experience.
Yeah.
Probably.
Well, that's the key is so art versus entertainment is a big not argument, but like a point that's talked about in a lot of fields. Comedy is a fun one to talk about. It's just like, is there a meaning behind what you're saying, or like, are you just going for the laugh? Which I'm a big entertainment guy right now. I can say that, but it's in the video game world as well, where it's like now becoming more popular. Or at least the technology is easy enough to get to that people can make something that they like. So there's more like little games out there that are more about the experience that it creates and what it makes you think, and less about like look at the cool stuff we can do. And that's
yeah, and I can see that point. I think ironically, a lot of people who get involved in video games are a little ADHD, and that's what sucks them in. But I think ironically, the problem with me is I'm like even more ADHD than that. Like I can't carve out that much of my life to like sit in front of it, because I have a computer job too, so I spend a lot of time in front of a computer screen anyways, and I kind of feel like these consoles are an extension of that.
That's just a computer on its side.
Right, you know, and you use your TV for the screen or whatever. But I'm just so ADHD I can't even like carve out like that much time to play these video games. And I've always been that way, which is weird because I work in the IT field, and every single person I work with
is a big
guy. Always been a video gamer, always. And I've always been that guy who's just like, yeah, whatever.
That's who you are, though. That's fascinating. I want to talk about, a big thing that really has been interesting me in Buddhism is the few concepts that I seem to happen upon, like the idea of impermanence. Always seem to ring true with where modern science is coming to. So the Buddhism talks often about cyclical nature of life. What's something great is there's a lot of like kind of crazy out there physicists right now talking about how, for example, there's not just one big bang, there's many big bangs, and as the universe expands, it'll get to a point where it'll have to contract again, and then it'll bang out again, and it will just kind of be the cyclical pattern. And I don't know, the idea of not actively fighting scientists and philosophies is just so fascinating to me.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a deep subject you're touching off on there, though. I mean, that can go in many different directions. One of the things that always fascinated me about Tibetan culture specifically, because my main exposure to Buddhism has been Tibetan, and there's actually, mm-hmm. you know, many different types of Buddhism. You know, it came out.
There's a Vietnamese monk I'm really into. I just can't pronounce his name. It's like Thin Nhat Hanh.
Yeah, it came out of India, and it was in parts of China for a while, and it's in Tibet. So you end up with all these different schools and whatnot. And one of the things that always kind of interested me about Tibet in particular, and the conflict between sort of religion and science, and then maybe, as you said, the confluence between religion and science eventually, was Tibet seemed to have this really advanced religious model, in my opinion. And I'm not very religious, and I'm not Buddhist. But they had this really backwards technological knowledge, you know, which was always really strange to me. But I guess it makes sense, considering they were still kind of an archaic culture. But, you know, these are people who had such a highly advanced religious ideal that the ultimate goal in their religion was everybody in the world achieving happiness and peace. Like, you can't think of a better, like, goal to strive for, right? Like, it seems like they kind of nailed the spirituality thing. When you look at all these other fanatic religious nut jobs, who their ultimate goal is to kill everybody who doesn't believe in them until the only people left are people who think the same way they do. It's just completely ridiculous. But at the same time, these are people who also, when there was like a lunar eclipse, they would stand on the roof of the buildings and they would bang on pots and pans to try to scare away like whatever evil demon it was that was, you know, clouding out the moon. So it was really kind of a strange, culture. Like, it was almost like all their eggs were in the religion basket, you know. and so there were kind of, you know, some divides there. And, you know, Rinpoche was kind of superstitious about a few things, too. And, of course, this is a guy who's, like, old-school Tibetan, and he was tapped as an incarnate, like, when he was very, very young and raised pretty much in, like, seclusion. And I remember, I don't know if I should say this, but we had this waiter at the cafe. And because it's funny, because when you learn about, when you meet a Rinpoche, when you meet a guy whose entire life revolves around hoping that the rest of the world can achieve peace and happiness and enlightenment. And this guy was legit. Like, he honestly, like, that was his goal in life. And he would spend hours and hours a day praying and meditating and focusing on this, like, singular idea and concept. Like, he was really into it. And when you meet the guy, like, you could believe that he was hundreds and hundreds of years old. It just was very believable, like, in the weirdest way imaginable. And I'm not very superstitious. I don't believe in ghosts and stuff like that. I'm a skeptic about a lot of things. But there's something about, and I met a lot of these Rinpoche guys, and there was something about every single one of them. Say what you want, like, who knows about reincarnation and all that, but at the very least, they were getting results mentally for themselves by doing what they were doing, and it was very amazing results. But the funny thing is, a lot of people, when they think about these guys and they think, oh, they're enlightened, they're perfect beings, they can do no wrong or whatever, but then the irony is, when you hang out with guys like that, you see they're still human. Like, that's part of the game, that's part of the trip, is like, they still have to be human beings in order to have this experience and continue this idea and this ethos,
right?
And it would come out in the weirdest ways, though. Like, we had this waiter at the cafe. He was this gay guy, and there was a bar down the street called Bullwinkle's, and it's probably still there. It was a Bloomington, like, national pastime. It was a gay bar, and every Thursday night they would have this drag show. And I hope this podcast doesn't just, like, blow up. I don't tell very many people this story. But every Thursday night they would have this drag show. And this waiter that we had at the cafe would go down there, and he was like a big star of the show, you know. He had this whole persona and whatever. And he just loved Miss Norbu, and she loved him. But she really, like, she had this weird, like, idea about homosexuality. Like, in her, she just kind of had this cognitive dissonance about it, you know. She, like, never really acknowledged that he was gay, but she loved, one of the things she loved about him was his femininity, you know. She just loved, like, gossiping with him and stuff like that. So he was telling her, look, you got to come down to this place I go on Thursdays, right? You should come check this out. It's what I do in my spare time, and we're friends. We should go do this. So finally she's like, all right, let's go do this. And Miss Norbu was, like, easily in her 60s at the time. I was never really sure. Like, she looked like she was, like, 80, but she had the energy and the mental cognizance of, like, a 21-year-old. She was just crazy like that. And she's like, all right, yeah, let's go do this. So he takes the Dalai Lama's sister-in-law to this drag show, and she loved it. She had the best time in the world. And when she came back, it's all she could talk to me about was she loved, like, all these beautiful women, and then they would come up to her and they would talk in these really low, like, man, and she was like, just the juxtaposition of it just blew her mind. She just loved that. And it was funny. So once this waiter, I forget his name, realized that she was accepting of this culture, he would bring in pictures and stuff, and they would look at the pictures and laugh and talk. But whenever Rinpoche walked in, boy, everything, it was like James Bond mode, like, oh, you can never tell Rinpoche. Rinpoche can never know. And it never did come up around him. Like, I would be surprised if he, like, really took offense or was angry by it, but it at least speaks a little bit to this idea that you think of these people as enlightened human beings, and then every once in a while, their humanity comes out in really glaring ways. And
yeah.
And I'm not saying Rinpoche was homophobic, because I never in my life, like, saw anything that would lead me to believe that. And we hired, you know, it's just the way the food industry is. A lot of servers are gay. And we hired plenty of them, and he never had a problem with any of them. But Miss Norbu seemed to be under the impression, at least, that this whole, like, drag queen culture was something that just had to be, like, hidden. Like, I don't know if maybe she just didn't want him to know that she was going or whatever. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and... Miss Norbu used to love to tell me a story about one time Rinpoche got pulled over, and he'd had a couple beers to drink, you know, and he told the cop, like, oh, no, I'm fine, and just went on his way, you know. So, you know, it's funny, you know, and there's actually books out there about, you know, enlightened madmen or whatever. These people weren't crazy, but it's just, it was a really, really amazing experience to know and hang out with people like that, and see both sides of it and the humanity, and just, you know, they were great people. That was some of the best time of my life.
Now, someone at his level with that title, are they considered to have already achieved enlightenment or still be just farther along the path towards it?
Well, I think that could be up for debate. I think the idea is you have to achieve a certain degree of enlightenment in order... There's a book out there called The Tibetan Book of the Dead.
Yeah, this is what got this all started for me.
Yeah, and it's supposed to be read to somebody who's in the process of dying. And it describes what they call the various different bardos. And bardos are considered to be different states of existence once you've passed on. And you have to transcend various different bardos before you can reach nirvana, which is considered the classic one with everything style of enlightenment. And the bodhisattvas and the Rinpoches sort of go up to that point and then stop so they can come back and be reincarnated and do it all over again.
So the
argument would be, like, a lot of these guys, when they're meditating, they're preparing for that death experience so they can have their wits about them, so to speak. Because one of the things that the Tibetan Book of the Dead focuses on is that dying can be very distracting and very terrifying. And if you're not, like, focused and calm, then you can sort of get lost in this Buddhist idea of purgatory, because you're not going through the process. You know, it just kind of, you become absorbed by all of the chaos and whatever. So, you know, there could be an argument to be made that you have to be enlightened in order to properly traverse the bardos and come back as a human being. But at the same time, there can be an argument that could be made that once you come back and incarnate as a human being, you kind of have to have the enlightenment reinstilled back in you to a certain extent. Because somebody like Rinpoche, Norbu Rinpoche, he was recognized to be a reincarnation of a monk called Thagster Rinpoche, who had one of his own schools. And so the argument could be that Thagster Rinpoche had attained enlightenment because he was able to go through the bardos and come back as a human being. But then Norbu Rinpoche was tapped at a very early age, like when he was younger than 10. I can't remember exactly.
I actually watched a documentary on the Book of the Dead, and when they went out and found one of these young kids that they believed used to be...
Yeah, and then they train them, you know. So the idea is they're enlightened beings, but they still have to be trained. They almost have to be reminded, and then hopefully... their previous life experience makes it easier for them to pick up where they left off. Like, maybe they didn't attain enlightenment until they were 60 or until they died or whatever, but then they come back, maybe they attain enlightenment at 12 this time, you know, and it's easier. So, you know, and it's not like once you, I guess the answer is, it's not like once you attain it, you're just there, you know. So whether or not Norbu, I mean, then I don't know. It's a tough question, because then you got to define enlightenment, you know. What exactly does that mean? All I know is whenever I met these Rinpoches, they were all amazing people. And I'm sure they had their faults. Like I said, with Norbu Rinpoche, you know, I heard stories and stuff like I told you. But it still didn't take away just the incredible, like, presence that these people had. It was just amazing, you know.
That's That's awesome. I don't even know what to ask now.
Well, like I said, I didn't want to turn this into a Buddhism
well, I did.
Thing, but you know, it's actually something that I don't talk about very often. So,
do you find? I guess you said you weren't. You're not. You don't consider yourself a Buddhist.
No.
So, other than your paintings, do you let it in other parts of your life still?
Well, one of the things that was really strange to me, and this is why part of the reason earlier I said that it seems like the most random coincidences in a person's life can later define them in certain ways. My parents, when I was born in Vancouver, British Columbia, and my parents were heavily involved in Tibetan Buddhism, just coincidentally, at the time that I was born. And there was another Rinpoche, whose name escapes me now. He's been dead for a while. I think it was Kumbum Rinpoche, maybe. He was teaching my parents at the time. They were studying under him when I was born. And Kumbum, I'm pretty sure that was him. He was part of what's called, there's different schools even within Tibet of Buddhism, and he was part of what was called the Yellow Hat, and the Yellow Hat is the same lineage of the Dalai Lama and Norbu Rinpoche. And so they were heavily studying that, and so when I was born, it was just part of the practice, you know, that they tie, they had like this sacred knot that they call, that they tie around infants' necks, and then they wear it until it falls off, and that sort of formally initiates them into the Yellow Hat, you know, school.
Mm-hmm.
But for whatever reason, this detail was just left out of my life, like when I was growing up. Like my mom never talked about it because I think she just felt like it, you know, it was kind of like just this crazy hippie thing they did when I was born, and why bring it up or whatever. But it really seemed like a powerful coincidence many years later when I finally called my mom and I was like, man, you're never going to guess what I just found out at work, you know? Oh. And she was like, oh, well, this is a weird coincidence because blah, 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 you know? And then the other weird coincidence, and I might be getting this all screwed up, but I'm pretty sure this is correct. The Rinpoche in Vancouver that tied the knot around my neck, when he died, they've already found his reincarnation, and they found him here in Seattle, Washington. So that was like another like weird, like I don't consider myself a Buddhist or whatever, but it seems like it's been kind of following me around like my whole life. Like it's a weird like thing, but it was fun. My little dabblings in it was fun, but I don't. Every spiritual belief and religious ideal just seems so dogmatic to me, and I don't have time for that, you know.
You seem like more one of the people who takes like a lesson, learns it, and kind of moves on without having to subscribe to the entire school.
Yeah. I finally decided that everything's a meditation if you do it right. So
that's one of the most beautiful things I've ever heard in my life.
I'm not going to sit around for 8 hours. I'll just, you know, if I can convert everything I'm doing to meditation, then I'll be one hell of a meditator, right? I won't have to.
You know, that's actually what really got me into Zen. I think there was a quote about like, how do I enter Zen while washing a dish? And then the reply was, well, true Zen is just actually washing the dish. And just that idea of like putting yourself into whatever task you're doing, turns everything you're doing into almost its own meditation.
I kind of say it half jokingly, but there's also a lot of truth there. Everything really can be a meditation. It's all how you approach stuff. And ironically, another aspect of Buddhism is ego dissolution. And that was another thing that I got really, really into for a while, was this idea of kind of breaking down the ego and shedding yourself of that. And ironically, that's one of the reasons I got into comedy, because I found nothing is a quicker, more effective tool for carving away the ego than getting up on that stage and just bombing miserably in front of so many strangers that you've never met before, and just seeing the look of dissatisfaction and distaste on their face, and you walk away and you feel like the worst person in the world. But the strangest thing is, like, and every comic goes through this, you reach a point eventually where whenever, and it happens, it will always happen in any comic's career, and you reach a point eventually where when it happens, like, you, in a weird way, you feel stronger about it. You're like, I know what I did wrong, and I know what I screwed up, and your daily interactions with people change too, because suddenly, like, you don't really think of yourself as quite the special little snowflake that you used to, you know, because you've and you have friends that are comics, and then you have to go up there and like endure that experience in front of them, or like your girlfriend shows up and your family or whatever. And the more you do it, like the more it really does kind of chip away at your ego in a good way, I think, you know. Although there are a lot of morons up there who, for whatever reason, are so emotionally disturbed that it doesn't affect them. They go up there and they bomb over and over and over again, and it's all part of the fun for them. But for me, you know, it's kind of, you know, it carves away another little piece. And so there's something to be said for that, I guess.
I think I like how they say that a lot. I think one of the bigger benefits I found from starting this is that it was almost like the playground in which to become a better person.
Yeah.
It gave me actual things to do to start thinking about.
The weird thing is, and this is one of the things that I actually unfortunately don't like about comedy, is...
Don't get me wrong, though. There is a lot of traps to become a horrible person.
Exactly. Exactly. There's so many, like, bad traps. Because, you know, and I find myself doing it, too. Like, you sit around at an open mic and you just get pissed off and, like, this is terrible and... You know, these comics are terrible and these people in the crowd are terrible and there's only six people here and I'm going up last and this whole thing's terrible. And you just get in this weird mindset, and that's why I said earlier, like, you have to, it's not about them, it's about you. And if your fun is dependent on the other people that show up, they're the ones who had the courtesy to show up. They want to have fun more than you do. They're there, yeah. Right? So
it's weird to remember that, like, they want you to do well.
Yeah, you know, they just want to have fun. And if you're not having fun, there's so much shit on TV, you know, go home. Like, it's so, and I just say that for myself because I have to remind myself sometimes because I'll fall into those traps about just getting so negative and cynical and jaded about the whole process. And that's the exact opposite of what it's all about, you know. You just got to go up there and enjoy yourself and have fun. And it doesn't matter. I mean, you got to be in that zone where you could get up on that stage and have fun even if you were the only person in the building. You know, that's where you got to be. And it's a hard place to get, you know. It's easier said than done.
God. Well, Joe, I think we got to go soon, but that was fucking amazing. That was...
Well, there's my little stories about really Bloomington and the Tibetans.
I'm so glad I got to hear them. That was incredibly unexpected and wonderful. Do you have anything cool coming up in 2 weeks or so?
Oh no, I'm not cool at all. Nobody invites me to the cool kid games, and
says the guy who just opened for Joe Rogan. All right,
I didn't open for Joe Rogan. It was more like a guest spot, you know. But it was still one of the most amazing times in my life. I've done that a few times. That one felt the best for me. That was a lot of fun.
I heard you had a really good set.
It felt like it. This was the first time I wasn't overwhelmed by the more. I've done it 3 times now, and the first time, I don't even know how I got through it. It was, I don't know. And the second time was just a blur, but better. This time, I actually like looked around and thought about what
like
I
present.
Was doing. And like did my thing. And man, it was one of the most amazing experiences ever. It was only 15 minutes, but still, 15 minutes in front of like 2,000 people, and they were loving it. You know, it was just like. And those spotlights from the back is—it's just crazy, man. It was crazy. But so, you know, once a year I do something cool.
Yeah.
So next year I'll be doing a guest spot for Joe Rogan,
next
probably.
Year, Joe Rogan. We'll have to get you on something cool. I've started putting some crappy things around Seattle.
I have a great idea for a show that I might do once I get the technology together, but that's for another time.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for doing this. This is a fucking blast.
Thanks for having me. And I guess that's how we do.
Yeah, that's how it is.